and we won't have to cry no more.
Welcome to Tavern and Y'all, a weekly podcast about the stories we tell while on pilgrimage as queer Catholics. I'm Jacob Flores, and I'm looking forward for Holy Week at home.
So we're recording this on Holy Thursday. Do you have any plans for the rest of the couple of days of Holy Week?
I watched the Tenebrae service that, here we go, my home parish, St. James Cathedral in Seattle, live streamed. So beautiful, so beautiful. I'll watch the rest of them that they do the rest of this week. But other than that, I mean,
it's about all you can do.
That's really all I can do. What about you?
And I'm his husband, Patrick Flores, and I am definitely ready for an Easter coronavirus miracle because I've also been stuck in this apartment for a long time now. And I just want to point out that Jesus couldn't even make it for 3 days in the cave. And he also took a long vacation to go visit the souls in hell in the middle of all that. So I think that we are placing a lot of expectations on ourselves to just sit for weeks at home. So,
would you go visit souls in hell?
Absolutely. Oh, to get out of the apartment for a little while.
You get to fly out every week,
which is my equivalent of visiting the souls in hell.
Yeah. Anyways, so you know, well, I don't know, but after reading the story from the author that we have on our podcast today, apparently there are a lot of gay priests and bishops out there.
You knew that,
though. I didn't know that, no. I mean, I can kind of tell when I meet a priest and he's a little friendly, or what we used to call a friend of Dorothy.
Mm-hmm, right.
little sugar in their water, a little pep in their step.
Yeah, okay. You're getting a feel.
But yeah, I had no idea that it was such a big thing.
Yeah, very widespread.
For priests, especially in seminary, like a widely known thing. But I guess I'm out of the loop. I guess that's why I'm a convert. So while you were in seminary, or I mean, even outside of seminary, growing up throughout your whole life as a Catholic, have you ever gotten an impression that a priest was attracted to you? That sounds creepy. That sounds really creepy. But I guess have you gotten any impressions that they were gay? And I don't know, maybe thought that you were attractive.
I definitely, while I was in seminary, I certainly got a lot of vibes from some of the priests on staff that, like, maybe they you could tell they, like, maybe took a little bit of an extra interest in some of the more attractive seminarians, and they got a little bit extra time and stuff like that. There was one moment when there was a brief period for a story for another day that I ended up kind of unaffiliated with any diocese. Like, normally you're sponsored by your diocese to go to seminary. And there was a visiting bishop who I'll leave nameless for now. And I got to meet him. And when he found out that I didn't have an official diocese, he invited me to come visit him in his diocese. And he flew me out there. And, like, his attractive priest secretary met me at the airport, took me to his apartment, and, like, dropped me off, and we were gonna, like, have dinner. And at the time, I didn't think it was weird at all. I guess I kind of just went with it. But, like, we sat there, or we, like, cooked dinner together, like a very fancy dinner, and then, like, just sat at his table and had dinner, like, just us. And, like, then a couple more times he, like, flew me out to his
diocese. So is this where all my fucking money is going to? For flights so that they can fly out?
That definitely came from that diocese's...
I'm not Catholic anymore.
Coffers, yeah. So at the time, I didn't think much of it, but looking back on it now, for sure, like, it was just a weird... Like, nothing sexual at all happened, but it was a... I can tell now, like, that was definitely him just wanted to spend time with it.
That doesn't need to be any sexual advances happening, but you could definitely feel when someone is inviting you into their presence so that they can enjoy you.
Yeah.
It's really, I don't know how I feel about that.
Yeah. I look back on it as a very gross time. This person is also the most vocal U.S. bishop that I know that's, like, very homophobic to the extent of saying that gay people shouldn't even be allowed to be have a priest at their burial. So that gives you a little glimpse into, like, the weird double life that he had going on and the internal struggles that he had going on.
Or maybe he actually isn't gay, and he clocked you and knew that you were gay, and he wanted to, I don't know, bring you into his little anti-gay priest army.
Also a possibility. Yeah. It didn't work anyway.
anti-gay priest armies aside, what's going on our podcast today?
Well, today on the podcast, I had the opportunity to talk with Frederic Martel. He is the author of the bombshell book, Inside the Closet of the Vatican, here in the U.S., and it was released under the title Sodoma in the rest of the world. It is a crazy book, like a batshit crazy book, not because of the way it's written per se, but just the details that it gives out of this kind of extremely pervasive culture of double lives and homophobia within the priests and bishops and even cardinals of the Catholic Church. He kind of told me all about these dozens of interviews that he had with clerics who just opened up to him about their own sex lives and dished on their fellow clergy members. I'll admit, it's a lot to take in. It sounds crazy, but there's a reason why, like, even the National Catholic Reporter called his book like an earth-shaking expose of clerical corruption. Naturally, I had a lot of questions for Frederic, like, how on earth do you get these priests and bishops to open up to you like this, and what does the Pope think about your book, and how do we fix such systematic abuses of power and silence? Frederic is gay himself, though he doesn't consider himself Catholic any longer, but he started our conversation with a beautiful story that I think shows he believes Catholicism and homosexuality can go together without any friction. Frederic Martel is an author and the host of the weekly radio program Soft Power on French National Public Radio. He's a senior researcher at the Zurich University of the Arts and is a foreign affairs columnist at Slate France. His new book, In the Closet of the Vatican, has been a bestseller around the world, and we are very grateful that he spent some time with us. He spoke to us online from his home in Paris. Now here is a story by Frederic Martel.
Bonjour. My name is Frederic Martel. I'm French. I live in Paris. I'm a French writer. I wrote several books, and my last book is called Sodoma. It's in English, In the Closet of the Vatican. It's a work about the Vatican and I would say one of its singularity, basically, the gay issue and homosexuality. But before going to this book, I would like to share my personal experience in France, in Paris, where I am right now, in my apartment, exactly like in many other cities and places in the world. I cannot go out, you know. I have to be closeted in a way in my house. And I decided it's already more than 2 weeks, and it's going to be probably another 2 weeks at least, to 1 month. I decided to dedicate this month to work on a French poet named Arthur Rimbaud. He's pretty well known as one of the most famous, maybe the most famous French poet. And it's an interesting figure, and I dedicate my months on him, basically reading everything he wrote, which is not too difficult because he wrote very little, only a couple of hundred pages, not even. But I also read dozens of books about him, biography. By the way, many are from American or English writers. Mm. Susan Sontag, Edmund White, Jack Kerouac, people like the Beat Generation, but also Bob Dylan and people like Patti Smith and Robert Mapplethorpe and many other Americans love Rimbaud. And what is interesting for me is that Rimbaud is both, I would say, a Catholic writer and a gay writer. Mm. He's a Catholic writer because he was a Catholic. He grew up Catholic. He was very involved in church until age 15. His mother was extremely Catholic. And he spent a lot of his poems are related to Catholicism, even especially the first one, when he was, Rimbaud wrote everything between age 15 and 20, and then he stopped forever. And then he went to Africa and what is now Yemen in Saudi Arabia, and also Saudi Arabia, which is at that time was, we call it a city like Aden, where he lived. And so when he was young, he wrote many poems about Catholicism, and also a lot of them are also related to the gay issue, because he was gay and in love with another poet named Paul Verlaine. And I think it's extremely interesting because you have both a Christian lecture, a Christian version of his poetry that you can analyze, and also a gay version. And they are the same poems, and you can think is a pure Catholic or pure gay. And in fact, he was probably both in a way, even though he also was very critical against his own homosexuality and also very critical against his own Catholicism. Mm-hmm. And I would say, to finish with this story, is that you can combine homosexuality and Catholicism. It's not easy, as his life and his poetry shows, but at the same time, in a way, it works together, because in both cases, it's about believing on something more than yourself. It's also being in a faith, and also being sincere and being your in your own truth. That was my story.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Thank you for sharing about Arthur Rimbaud with us. Can you tell me, Frederic, what, as you've been studying him, what piece of his life did he find that his homosexuality and maybe even this relationship with this other young man allowed him to believe that to be a gay person was about being, you know, just more than himself, as you mentioned?
Yes, because he wrote many, many poems and also short books, A Season in Elf, especially, that is also to share an experience, to share also a vision about women. He was very feminist in a way, very early on. And also about, you know, the fact, I'm not a big, you know, gay and gender studies guy, because for many reasons, I think it's sometimes a bit reducing people to something. But he is a kind of a king for gender studies, because in a poetry can change a man can become a woman. There is mix. There is a double sex. There is a lot of, for example, in A Season in Hell, which is his most famous book and the only one actually he published when he was alive. It's a book when he speaks using a feminine name as if it's his boyfriend, Paul Verlaine, that speaks. So it's a kind of a complex, I would say, multiple identities. And I would say the multiply, the plurality of identities is one key element of his poetry.
Mm, that's extraordinary. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. Do you mind if I ask some questions about your book, In the Closet of the Vatican?
No, of course not.
Over the course of your research, you interviewed, I believe, 42 cardinals and dozens of bishops and priests and seminarians. How did you get so many clergy to speak so openly with you about their own sex lives and even those of their fellow clergy?
Things are very different, depending if you speak to a priest or sometimes a bishop or a cardinal. As a rule, a cardinal and even a bishop speaks very rarely about himself. When I speak about homosexuality, it's always about the homosexuality of other cardinals, not their own.
Yes.
With priests, it's very different because, I mean, of course, you have much more priests than cardinals. And so there is a huge number of priests that are, I wouldn't say openly gay, but at least gay, and ready to some extent to share their experience, because they know it's not their fault, it's not bad, and they know also the Catholic Church is the last, you know, place where we need to have this kind of movement of going out of the closet. It's the last closeted, really big place, probably in the world. And so they speak out to share their point of view and to share also their experiences. They do that sometimes with their real name. People in my book does that sometimes. Mm. Sometimes they prefer not to be quoted totally with the full name, but sometimes they accept just their first name or sometimes the city where they are and so on. But to answer your question, the way I work was, I mean, it was a long book and a long process. I spent 5 years doing that. And basically, I decide to live in Rome for a long time, basically 1 week every month for 4 years. And, you know, you don't go to see a cardinal and say, hey, guy, I'm Frédéric Martel. I'm going to publish in the closet of the Vatican, and you're going to be the hero of my book. Of course, it doesn't work like that. But when you meet somebody, and it's always very cold, and they are very careful, you know. But I never lie. They knew who I was. I always had my real name. I always was clear about the fact that I was a writer, a journalist, writing about the Vatican. And step by step, you're there. And then you come back after a month and another time after 2 months and 6 months and 1 year and 2 years. So you become a bit of friend step by step. Mm.
You build up some trust.
Yes. And you know, you don't betray them, but basically they change their mind, and they also sometimes invite you to go with them for events, dinners, and then sometimes I was invited to live in the Vatican, to live also in some monasteries and so on and so forth. And you know, they are gay people, so there is a time when they act with you as you are gay people in the same way. Mm. For example, when I live in the Vatican in three different places, I was with one of what I call my cardinal. You know, I lived in his apartment. They have big apartments. They are in general alone, and they have many rooms. And so that's a normal thing to invite their family and their friends to live with them sometimes, like I will say a normal person. So when they invite you, you're their friend. You have a key, you can enter by yourself. You don't even have to go through the Swiss guard or the gendarmeria. Hmm. You live with them. And then, you know, sometimes we were saying with my cardinal, let's have a dinner tonight. And so we bought food in the morning. We invite people at night, 8 p.m., always very early. 3 or 4 people from our building come for dinner. And that was a gay dinner. I mean, people were in a normal way. We of course didn't say, oh, it's a gay dinner, of course. But
sure.
It was. I mean, they came with their boyfriend. We had a kind of a conversation that was with code, but pretty clear. And, you know, this is how I met assistant of famous cardinal, even Pope. And I know they are gay because they were with me as gay people in a gay dinner.
So those you interviewed, they claimed often that the majority of the highest ranks of the curia, the in the Catholic Church, that they are both gay and leading a kind of double life. Can you explain a little bit about how a culture like that is possible? Because I think for so many of us who grew up within the Catholic Church, you imagine the Vatican as being a very pristine and holy place. And it's very difficult to imagine that it's not, you know, yes, we hear of scandals, but it's always maybe one person but how is it possible that there's this entire culture going on within the Vatican?
First of all, I'm not interested in scandal. So for me, the subject of the book is more the majority, the silent majority, than the scandals that we all know. And I know the scandals. I mean, for example, in the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith, when I was in the Vatican, they were organizing chemsex parties there, which is a party. Wow. With cardinals. At least one cardinal, and I know his name, was in the party, and he was people, priest and non-priest, having sex and drugs and alcohol and Viagra at the same time. Mm-hmm. Well, when I say that, it's not a rumor. Police, the gendarmeria, had ended up arresting everybody, and it made page one of the newspaper in Italy. And I knew that before it was public. So These kind of scandals arrive. I mentioned them in the book, but that's not my subject. My subject is what you said, a culture of secrecy. The fact that these people are human people. And that's the point. You said, we believe it's a moral, I don't remember the name you used to describe this Vatican. You said
that it's almost like a holy place.
Yes, it's a holy place. But it doesn't mean for me that they are not as much holy than if they are gay. It doesn't mean that they lie, because a lot of them are not even lying. They are just don't say anything. I don't speak here about the, of course, the big homophobic cardinal that are speaking out. In general, they are very gay when they do that. But yes. I'm speaking about the regular guy that tries to combine his faith and his sexuality. And I'm pretty sure he's a good priest. I really believe that he's doing things in the good direction. However, he is gay, as some others are straight. When I say they are gay or homosexual, it doesn't necessarily mean that they all have sex and prostitute and multiple partners. You have 50 shades of gay in the Vatican. A lot of them are homosexuals, but without acting, without partners, without sex. What we used to call, you know, in the 1950s, homophiles, people without acting, even though they are gay. And they are gay because they have a gay culture. Because if they will have sex, will be with a man and not a woman. And also because this culture of secrecy, their secret, has also a lot of importance on sometimes when they speak against gay people, it's also because they are gay themselves. And so it has a lot of consequence and influences. So this very big diversity from the homophile to the one that has prostitute, which also exists, makes me, you know, shows me that a priest is a normal person. And and that's a good message. He's a normal person. It means he also loves. He also he has feelings. He has excitement. He would like to be with people, with some people, either sometimes a woman or a man. And at the end, it's a good news because for me, the point is very simple. Being in celibacy and chastity is counter-natural. It's not a normal thing. And right now, we have thousands of priests, that are in the world accused of sexual abuses. It means these people were supposed to be chaste and they actually abuse kids or either women or young boy. Actually, quite often more boys than girls because 80 to 85% of the priests in trouble for their sexuality are in trouble because of the victims were boys or young men. It shows that what is a problem is the culture of secrecy and the lie. The problem is not homosexuality by itself. The problem is not having a lover or a boyfriend or even having sex. And that's basically what I found out.
Yeah, I think there is a level, especially for me, I don't know if I mentioned this to you, but I was in the seminary for a number of years. And I can recognize part of what you're saying of the number of young men who join the seminary as a way to kind of hide and just try to deal with their sexuality. I remember there's a passage in your book of a story of a young man who comes out to his mother, and the mother responds, "Well, at least we'll have another priest in the family." And there's this sense that for a young gay man, if they are to be a good Catholic, that, you know, there's really no other choice that you have. And so, but there's also this sense in which you, in your book, the number of priests and bishops and even cardinals who are living these double lives, it's hard to kind of wrap your mind around, you know, as someone who has kind of grown up within so much of the Catholic Church and imagined it to be a good place where double lives were not accepted. So I'm curious, Frederic, when you were talking to these folks who had these double lives and who some of whom were often as well homophobic in what they teach and in what they preach, did they view their own behavior or the behavior of their fellow clergy members as harmful to anyone? Like, in other words, did they view themselves as kind of like an addict who can't help themselves? Or more like a politician who thinks that they are clever for what they've gotten away with.
You know, I like the way you describe the situation. And that's actually my subject. The subject is not about Cardinal A or Bishop B or Priest C to know if they are gay. The question and the subject is why a structure as the Catholic Church attracts, is interested, promote mainly gay people. And you gave the answer. The answer is, of course, it's celibacy. Because when you were, because that's a fact of the past, when you were a young homosexual of 15, 20 years old in the 1950s or 1960s, and you discover that something is wrong with you. You don't even put the name homosexual because it was a name that you didn't know or you didn't think you were gay, but something was wrong. You were not attracted by women. You didn't want to marry. It's like an impossible solution for you to go ahead. Then you think about the church. And becoming a seminarian and a priest means you don't have to marry. You can, you know, you can dress sometimes a bit like a woman. You can sing. You can live only with men. And you know, basically decide what the future will be for you. So you put your homosexuality in kind of control, but at the same time in a safe place. And even your mother, that knew that something was wrong, more than anybody else, of course, she's so happy by this very, you know, unique vocation that suddenly appears and make you a priest. And your former friends, you know, the one that were sometimes making joke already against you, you know, at the university because you were too effeminate or something. Now they respect you as a priest. So you becoming a priest, you transform, I would say, a weakness to a strength. And that's basically what I'm telling you here. It's not just theory. It's the life of millions of priests in the last century and maybe before that. So it explains why the debate on homosexuality, but also the debate on celibacy, chastity, and the marriage of priests and everything like that is a sociological question. It's not a question about, again, X or Y or Z. It's about a sociology that attracts the people that are gay and promote them in the Catholic Church.
Frederick, those you interviewed, they often seemed to enjoy the kind of gossipy quality to the conversation, that they were able to give a little bit of dirt about ex-cardinal or ex-priest or so-and-so who, you know, maybe was the assistant to the cardinal. And yet publicly, as you said, there is this system of silence and cover-up. Who do you hope hears and even believes the stories that you've shared in this book? Who do you think needs to hear these stories the most?
First of all, I'm not interested in gossip, and I don't out cardinals or bishops. Of course, I listen a lot of things. If I will publish the podcast or the audio of many conversations with journalists, with priests, with bishops or cardinals, I mean, the Vatican will explode, basically. But that's not my job. That's not my goal. My goal is, I mean, I'm a journalist and a researcher and a professor. So my goal is to explain what's happening and to try to give to people the key to understand the system. So if I out someone, it's the Vatican. It's not the people. There is a few exceptions. I out some people that are dead for a long time because I think that's history. I out some people that were already outed by very big media, like I will say Cardinal McCarrick in the US, or I have outed people that are already accused of abuse of men or young men, which is a proof of their attraction to boys and to men. But otherwise, I don't. I mean, I don't mention anything. I just try to explain a system. And so, you know, for the question that is difficult for me to answer, who to whom I'm speaking, what are the people that have to listen to me. Once again, when you're a writer and you do a book, you're not a judge. So my goal is not to judge people. I'm not, it's not a trial. I'm not putting the people to ask them what they have done good or bad. I got since 1 year, basically in general 10 letters a day. I mean, letters, emails, message on Facebook, on Twitter, on LinkedIn or whatever. And these letters that I get are, in general, all of them are very positive. I mean, 98%, 99% are positive. And people in general, they don't even speak about my book. They say, when I read your book, I understand my own life. I understand why I was a priest and I left, why I was a seminarian and I never became a priest, why I was abused by this guy, why this guy was so friendly with me, why, I mean, any kind of thing. Sometimes it's crazy, sometimes it's not even possible to know if they say to you the truth. Sometimes they are priests that they write to me saying, you cannot answer me because this email is fake and you cannot reply to me because I don't want you to know who I am, whatever. But the story is that a book makes an impact when it shows the people that, I mean, actually everybody has already understood the story. But that's maybe the first time that somebody showed them in a book what it's all about. And it gives a confirmation of what they already I've begun to understand.
Yeah, I think that's very true. It's almost like a key to open a sort of understanding, something that you maybe feel instinctively around the church, and it's just enough to open the door and finally kind of see what's behind and what's been impacting and making you feel and perceive these things about the church. And I know you've said, Frederic, that you don't care, and you certainly don't judge any, you know, maybe priest or bishop who is sexually active or they have a boyfriend or anything like that. But I'm curious, what do you think it will take to change this culture of homophobia and double lives that do exist within the church so that it becomes the Catholic Church can be a place that is no longer homophobic, but also is no longer a place where priests and bishops feel that they need to have this sort of double life where everything is hidden?
You know, you have to understand the key element of both the situation and also, if I am a bit more self-centered, my own, the reason why I did this book. We are in 2020. It is totally different today than it was 10, 20, 30 years ago, or even more before. And if I was able to write this book, it's because things are different because of the sexual abuse crisis, but also because, you know, now people speak out because you have a camera and a photo on your phone. Everything is recorded. Everything as you can take photo all the time. People are speaking. The media are publishing. The witnesses are speaking out as well. And so this kind of secret cannot be kept alive. So if somebody would have written this book 10 years ago or 20 years ago, it wouldn't have been possible to publish it. And even today, it's still difficult in Italy as a journalist or a writer with your publisher, with your editor, to do a book like that. And I knew that. It's very difficult also to do it if you're a Vaticanist, because if you do that, you know, the Vaticanists are the journalists that are only working at the Vatican. If you do that, you lose your job. As simple as that. And if you are straight, I'm sorry to say that you don't understand. People don't understand, and they cannot make a book like that. This is why, in a way, it was done by a French writer who is not a Vaticanist, who has the code to understand the system, and in 2020. And things are totally different now. I mean, this is why we are just in the beginning of the story, and the story will be out all the time. I mean, every story will be out and again and again. I believe that the reason why the system has been possible so long, it's because, again, before, people wouldn't have spoken, people wouldn't have written, people wouldn't have even made some testimony. And the main reason is also that the cardinal, the vast majority of the cardinal are more than 75 years old. Quite often they are now 80. I met several cardinals of 95 years old.
Wow.
So if you want to understand these cardinals, the debate is not about 2020 and being gay and going to the gay pride. The story is how they were gay in 1940s or in 1950s. And that's why they still are in this world. The world where in 1950s, when you were gay, you were married with a woman you don't like. You were, or you like her, but you're not attracted by her because you were gay.
Sure.
Or people that were lying, or people becoming a priest, as we said before, because they were gay. And so this is why I'm very optimistic. In 10 years in France, we don't have priests. That's as simple as that. We have 800 priests that die every year in France right now, probably more because of the coronavirus, actually, and less than 50, 60, 70s that are ordained. So it means 800 die and 70 less than that are ordained. So it means in 10 years, there is no priest. That's it. So by definition, because of the transformation of the society, because of the priest being younger by definition, and the cardinals as well, the system will change. At least I believe that. This is why I'm optimistic.
What has been the reaction from the church since your book come out? I know you've mentioned that some have maybe emailed you privately, but publicly, what has been the reaction?
The Vatican itself, as a rule, for every kind of books, whatever the book on, when it's about economics, when it's about money, scandals, they don't react officially. So they didn't for this book, which is totally normal. What I know is that I'm still meeting the cardinals that I, not all of them, of course, but, you know, the one that I was close or I was living with, they are still accept me. And in general, people were, I mean, they might not agree with me and they might not like the book, but nobody said, you know, you betrayed me or you shouldn't have written that. Because actually, if you really read carefully the quotations, they are all very, they are nice in general. And I never kept the bad one or the gossip one and so on. The second thing is that the Pope himself said, not publicly and not to me, but he said to a very famous lawyer, I mean, person involved in the sexual abuse in Latin America, that he said three things. First, I read the book. Second, it's okay. Third, I knew everything.
That's extraordinary.
Extraordinary. And it was made public. You can find that easily in many newspaper and in Latin America and also in the US that quote this lawyer. You know, I think I did my homework. I published my book. People like it or not. In a way, that's not really my problem anymore. And, you know, I will move on to another subject. And that's the work of a journalist and a writer to do that.
Yeah, I think that your book, In the Closet of the Vatican, has been an incredible gift for the Catholic Church and especially for our community, Vine and Fig, because so many of our members have spent some time in the seminary or considering priesthood or maybe religious life if they're a woman. And it has allowed them to kind of understand a bit more of maybe why they felt so attracted to and also trapped in that life. And now that they have come to a place where they're a lot more free and a lot better and are able to reflect back on that time, I think your book has been a bit of a consolation and an understanding of a piece of the culture at which they were a part of for so long. I know it certainly has been for me. And so I'm very grateful for that, for you to write this book. And it's helped me understand so much of my time that I spent trying to understand my sexuality and my place in the church. So Frederic, I thank you for your time speaking with us today. Can you please tell everyone where they can find your work if they would like to find more of what you have written or are currently working on?
Basically, I have a website. That's my name, frederickmartel.com. I wrote another book called Global Gay that was published by MIT Press. It's a book about gay life in Arab Islam territories, but also China and in more than 50 or 49, I don't remember, countries. And In the Closet of the Vatican was published very recently in paperback, so that's easy to find on Amazon or wherever you want, even during the blackout of today. Whatever I would like to add is, again, the goal for me, it's not even to change the church. I mean, I'm not Catholic myself. I used to be Catholic when I was a little kid, and I stopped Catholic. I mean, it's not even stop. I mean, it's just normal things sometimes you were Catholic by your family at age 3, and when you are 12 or 13, that's all and finish, and that's it. It's not even a fight, and I never had a fight, or it was never revenge or whatever. It's just like basically the vast majority of French people. Now we have 3% of the population that go to church, 3%. So I would say Catholicism is finished in France, basically. And that's a bit the same in Spain or even in Italy today. So the question is not really to fight for a change. That's not really my problem. I mean, I'm in favor of this Pope. My book is a big support to Pope Francis. But if Francis is succeeding, or if he failed, in a way, that's not my priority or my goal to help him for that. What is important is to tell the truth and to try to understand why people can be blind in front of the more evident proof. And, you know, the Vatican is a system of lie, is a system of secret, is a system of double standards and double language. And again, my work is just it's not to be against the church, not to be against Catholicism, it's to be against hypocrisy. And I would even say schizophrenia to some extent.
Wonderful. Well, again, thank you so much for your time and all your work, Frederick.
Bye-bye.
Tabard In is a podcast by Vine and Fig, an affirming space and community for queer Catholics. You can find us on social media at Vine and Fig Co., and on our website at vineandfig.co. That's it for us this week on Tabard In. Happy Easter, and thanks for listening, y'all.
Bye, y'all. So what you're trying to say is there are daddy priests out there.
So grossed out right now.